Hello, Bears fans. Welcome back to another edition of Bears on Tap. I am Ron Luce. I am joined by the one, the only. He's back in action. We missed you last week, buddy. The one and only Mr. Quentin Q. Butkus Stats, whichever name you prefer to use to reference our friend here. Q, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good. I actually I didn't get to watch this last game. I listened on the radio, and it made me very appreciative of, you know, I don't listen on the radio that often, but Jeff Joniak and Tom Thayer, they are so good at their jobs. Like, I mean, they are. Announcing radio is a complete different animal than television, right? You're having to paint a whole picture and, like, describe exactly what's happening on the field at all times. Like, the amount of effort that must go into that from those guys and knowledge that they must have is incredible. So I just wanted to shout that out because it was awesome to listen to the Bears.
100%. I actually listened to about the first quarter myself on radio and then caught the rest of it on the old TV set. I agree with you. I think the way that Jeff Joniak paints the picture, right? You can tell everything that's happening, right? He could tell you what hash they're on. The ball's at this yard line. It's this down and distance. You know, Fields is in the gun. Cole Kmet coming from left to right across the formation. He's in tight.
Yeah.
Like, you can paint the picture in your own head of what's happening on the field. Agreed. Chicago's very lucky to have Jeff Joniak and Tom Thayer on the radio. They do an absolutely great job. Speaking of a great job, Justin Fields did a great job, at least in my opinion, at least from the high level, right? He's back. He had a good showing most of the week, 100 yards on the ground, almost 170 through the air, had the touchdown pass to DJ Moore in this one, which was pretty, really helped my fantasy team. So thanks, boys. I needed that one. But Q, let's just dive right into it here because I feel like there's two reigning topics that we really wanted to dive in here after this collapse against the Lions. And one of them is Justin Fields. He's back for the first time since dislocating that thumb against the Vikings about four or so weeks ago. What were your thoughts of Justin Fields' play, just high level here, in this return against the Lions?
Yeah, I thought the game plan was really, this was what we were expecting coming into the season, game plan wise. And it's what we hadn't seen. You know, it seemed like the Bears all season had really geared towards a more horizontal game, more classic West Coast offense, where, you know, shorter routes, winning with spacing, and not as much of the vertical attacking kind of mentality that we saw the second half last year, and we thought we were going to get more of this year. And why that matters for Justin Fields' game, I mean, it's hard to scramble in a horizontal offense. The defenders are much closer to you. They're much like the spacing does not work out for a running quarterback in a horizontal offense, right? In a vertical attack, you are forcing defenders downfield and opening up wide gaps for the runner to take advantage of. And I think that that's what we really saw the Bears doing on Sunday, was letting the receivers create those big spaces and letting Justin Fields take advantage of them. And I mean, I think it's something that I wish we'd seen sooner. I wish, because it's what Justin Fields' strength is, right? His deep ball and his speed. Getting those two things working in conjunction, it creates a lot more opportunities on offense. Now, that being said, I still do see moments where, like, I was just watching JT O'Sullivan's breakdown before we jumped on here to make sure, you know, because, like I said, I listened to the game. I didn't watch it. I haven't gotten the chance to review the All 22 yet, so I, you know, hit that Cliff Notes button and went to JT O'Sullivan on it. But you do see a few times where it's like, I don't know if structure is working for Fields still. I think we saw a lot of moments where he created out of structure very well, but the ability to see what is happening within structure and hit the throws within that structure that are there for the taking, that's still where I have some questions on my end.
No, and I think that's fair, right? And I think the largest part of that too is him missing time, right? That's 4 to 5 weeks of game tape that could be used, right? To maybe he's making some more of those throws. He's able to watch that film from the next week and you know, he's able to talk through it with Janako and Getsy and the rest of the unit and say, hey, this throws here for you when we do run this. Oh, okay, that's good to know. Because I feel like sometimes, especially with quarterbacks that might struggle a little bit with the read and recognition of structure, it's almost like the being told, like, hey, you're going to probably have this available. And even if it's not always there, knowing in the back of their mind that, oh, hey, maybe I can come back to my third read because it's going to be there, it is just something that a quarterback like that needs to know. Because if they have that in the back of their head, right, maybe it is truly 1-2-3 instead of 1-2 take off and go, because I don't know if I can get to my third read. So, but yeah. I agree with you there, right? It's hard, especially after missing a few weeks with that injury. That's just precious game reps that were taken away ultimately because of the dislocated thumb.
Yeah, and really, I mean, coming back from the dislocated thumb, it didn't seem to me like he was missing any zip, missing any throws because of it. Like, he might have one or two throws that were a little off the mark, but I don't think it was anything that was more than what you'd expect from any quarterback, not just him. Mm-hmm. Like, it seemed like the thumb was working just fine, and he, you know, any issues on missed throws were stuff that was pretty typical from him, as far as, like, there was one deep overthrow, I think, to DJ Moore. Mm-hmm. But it was barely an overthrow, you know, it was like a foot, and I can't blame that on the thumb as much as just like that kind of just happens, you know? But yeah, I think missing the reps out there probably hurt. I, like I said earlier, I really like that they went back to this game plan that we saw working so well last year, but the passed up opportunities that we see from him, I can't help but just wonder, like, you have a coach that really stresses turnovers and avoiding turnovers on offense. And it's just, you see a quarterback who's gun shy. Like, mm-hmm. Usually you see the opposite when you see a guy who's struggling to read and react and understand what he's seeing. It's a guy who is like trigger happy, a guy who is just throwing it into stuff that he shouldn't. And it's just odd to see from Fields. And it's something we started to see from Bajent too, as Bajent was getting more and more reps. Like early on. Oh my
goodness, yes.
Bajent's first game, he was just ripping it, right?
Yeah.
But then as he got more reps, more practice reps as the first string, like, it became more like, I can't take this risk, so I need to pass it up. And it is like, it's really starting to feel like the coaching is driving some of these issues of like, and I'm not sure if I can use that as an excuse to be like, well, get him a new coach and it'll be fixed. Cause it's like, we're in year three. We need to be seeing it, but it's this weird gray area that is just really tough to handle from a fan perspective, to handle from a, am I throwing my support behind Justin? Am I throwing my support towards a number one draft pick, towards you know what, and what does it all matter? Because I don't influence it anyways, but like it's the rooting interest, right? It's where your emotions lie. And like, for some fans, I think it's a lot easier to say, I can accept the losing because I know what's at the end of that tunnel. But on the other end, it's like, man, you can only do that for so long. You know, it's like it wears at you. So
it does. It does.
It just sucks to see when you see DJ Moore flying open, or Darnell Mooney flying open in the end zone. Or even there was a play where EQ was flying open in the end zone over the top of a safety who was pulled down on a in route. Like it was a Mooney in route, and EQ was running up over the top of the safety in a post towards the middle of the end zone, like clear behind the safety. And it's like, we didn't throw it, and Justin ended up scrambling because he brought his eyes down. And it's just kind of like, when Justin brought his eyes down, it wasn't exactly clear that the safety was going to post up on the in route yet, but it was like, right. It was bang, bang, you know, it was like, it's about to happen. And he didn't have the intuition to just sit there another split second and wait for it. His intuition was drop my eyes and run. And that's those, like, I'm not sure if those split decisions are something that changes now, like at this point in the guy's career. Maybe they are. Maybe they're not. We'll find out eventually.
Absolutely. But I really love the point that you brought up, because getting to sit there in person at the Thursday night game against Carolina, when it came to Bajent becoming gun shy, you saw it time and time and time again. Tyler Scott was wide open on two or three plays that ultimately became checkdowns. DJ Moore had a couple of long shots down the field. Hell, I think even Cole Kmet had one where he was streaking down the seam. And even if he wasn't confident throwing over 25 yards, it was like a 10, 15 yard, you know, streak down the seam that he passed up for a little dump off play. It really does seem that this coaching staff is harping, don't turn the ball over. And that's fine. I think that's great. But it's a lot easier to harp that, Q, when your defense is doing what they did on Sunday and taking the ball away three times, and then you get the special teams takeaway as well. Then, sure, yeah, you can play a little more conservative on offense because you're going to have those opportunities to go down and score, even if you are having to run the ball. The first drive was a perfect example of that. You get down, you drive, Fields makes a couple of really nice throws to keep the drive alive, and then you bang it in with Deontay Foreman, and you call it a day. It really does seem that it's hard to preach ball control when your defense can't take the ball away, because then it's right. Well, now you're just too much of a conservative offense instead of taking the risks that ultimately are needed at that point to make up for the deficiency. But to your point, right, I think we kind of got some of that finally here on Sunday. One other thing, Q, I wanted to bring up with you as well. You brought it up a little bit earlier about the run game. Fields took off and ultimately carried the ball 18 times, 104 yards. And with that, you know, wide open design and things like that, that really, really benefited him in this one, 269 yards, nice of offense in this one. But between Khalil Herbert, Roschon Johnson, and Deontay Foreman, which made up for 28 total carries, Herbert had 35 yards on 16 carries. Roschon had 30 yards on 6 carries. Foreman, 14 yards on 6 carries with the touchdown. That's it. They could not get the run game going for the life of them. And I know you mentioned, right, the run blocking and it, you know, it not making sense. And, you know, it really was a lot of this game felt like Fields was the run game. And maybe that's why that you know, hey, he's going to drop his eyes and take what the defense is giving him a little more because they know they can't run the ball. On the flip side, right, if it's the Deontay Foreman show like it was against the Raiders, like it was even kind of against Carolina, and you're able to consistently run the football down the field, then you can run more play action. Then maybe Fields is able to stay back there for that extra half second for EQ to come open over the top of the safety. It really does feel like this Bears offense can never get it all going at the same time. That's really what it is, right? Like the weeks that Fields has a pretty good game and they can throw the ball, the run game sucks. Or, you know, the coaching doesn't make sense and they fail to, you know, do anything with it. It just, everything feels all over the place. Nothing feels in sync right now with this offensive unit.
Yeah. I mean, with the run game, it feels like one of two things. It either feels like the O-line is being set up to fail or they are not understanding the checks. There's too much optionality in the run game, too much read based assignments. And I hate to be the guy sitting here, like saying, like being the meatball of just line up and punch the guy in the mouth across from you. Like, but I honestly think the Bears O-line is kind of good enough to do that. Like, yeah. Braxton Jones was a really good run blocker last year. This year we've yet to see the same guy. I almost wonder if you're giving him too much to think about out there sometimes. Because not to say he can't handle thinking and checks and different options, but like there are times where you're watching Braxton and it's like, it's just brain farts. And it's like, why is that happening to him? It might just be too much on his plate. And same with Tevin, there was a play where you had Darnell Wright lined up to the left of Braxton Jones. So you had double tackle on the left side.
Yep.
And then you had Tevin and I believe Lucas Patrick was still in their normal spots. So snap the football. And then you have Patrick, Jenkins, and Jones all pulling to the right. Is that like that? That's not a good run play. Like no, you had a three technique lined up right over Jenkins and you're pulling the guy to Jenkins left, the guy to Jenkins right, and Jenkins and giving the three tech a free run right into the backfield. And he takes down the ball carrier. What else is he going to do? He's getting a free run right to the handoff point. Like it's, and I'm sure there's something more of like, it seems like based on what JT was saying in his breakdown, Jenkins is probably supposed to stay there. He's probably supposed to stay home and cover the three tech. But that's where I'm saying the optionality of, like, you're making these guys have to think too much. And I'm not sure the Polars were necessarily that key to picking up a few yards there. Or I forget what down and distance it was, but maybe a first down. Like, mm-hmm. you had, it seems like this Bears running game, the simpler you get with it, the better it kind of gets.
Yep.
Like, when you're starting to throw all this calculus in there of you're bringing guys this way and the run's going the opposite way. And it, like, mm-hmm. that's when stuff seems to really be going wrong with this run blocking. 100%. So I don't get why it's such a point for them to make that happen. And I feel like there's a little bit of Getsy ego in there on it, because this is what he does, right? I mean, when he was at Mississippi State, he was a read option guy. This mm-hmm. is the stuff that this was his bread and butter. So it's what he tries to innovate with. It's what he tries to be that the hot new thing with, is really that run game and the RPO, or not in the read option game. Mm-hmm. And it just doesn't seem to work out as often as it should. And I think the deeper you get in with the film with it, the more maddening it can be, because mm-hmm. it seems so often the Bears are one block away from a home run.
Yeah.
But it's always a different guy missing the block, which makes me say, well, there's just too much on their plate, I think.
Yeah. And you know what? Even I'll use a real life example for me when I was in college. We had very minimal optionality within our run game. And granted, we saw a lot of different looks. We were a spread offense. Like, we got a lot of five in the box, which we all loved the juicy box. That was the best thing to run against in the entire world. But in general, we had inside zone, which is very straightforward. For those that don't know, it's, you know, one step to your left, get going upfield, and you're usually working stacks. That's how it's designed, right? Linebacker D tackle stack, linebacker DN stack, however that ends up working out, that's how you work it. And a pair of linemen will communicate, this is our stack, this is our stack. That's the free guy. Hey, this guy's the tight ends guy. Great. Outside zone, very similar, right? It, just a couple extra outside lateral steps. Same idea, though. It's 1-2. If you don't got anybody crossing your face, get upfield. If you got a guy crossing your face, run with him. But then the only time we ever really had optionality, we had a couple of pin and pull plays. And for those that aren't sure what the hell a pin and pull is, let's say there's a one technique between the right guard and the center on a certain play. If the play is designed to go to the right and you want a right leading puller going that direction, the pin is the right guard. He's coming on a down block onto that one tech. And then the pull is the center, and he's coming around and getting out there. You see it a lot with Jason Kelce and the Eagles, folks. Mm-hmm. You want an example of that? The Eagles love pin and pull with Jason Kelce because he's a freak athlete. We used to run that, and there were certain plays where, depending where the defensive tackle lined up, would depend who pulled and who pinned. And that was about it. Otherwise, everything else was basic and straightforward, right? Counter, you know, any sweeps, screens, things like that. It was all very simple. There wasn't a lot of decision-making to do, and we just got to use our athleticism and our brawn to make the plays. And I agree with you, Q. I think sometimes, especially at the NFL level, where the defense is going to have just as elite athletes as you do on the offensive side of the ball. This is not college. It's not Mississippi State, where maybe they're playing, you know, University of Southern Miss, and they can get away with being a little cute and a little fancy. Sometimes just big on big is the way to go with some of these offensive linemen. And to your point, I agree with you. I do think the Bears offensive line is good enough. This is probably the best offensive line we've seen the Bears have in quite some time, believe it or not. And I know that's not a high bar to put it at, but I mean, Jones has been good and he's healthy and he's back. Tevin Jenkins has been phenomenal. Nate Davis has been great this year. Darnell Wright's a stud. And I'll be honest, even Dan Feeney coming in looked pretty good coming in at center after.
Did we ever have a doubt with that mullet?
No. And he's a Chicago guy. Never a doubt. Never a doubt. But I'm right there with you, Q. I really do think there is a lot of confusion going on. And maybe that's a perfect way to segue us into our next topic. Because, Q, I wanted to ask you about the decision-making of this coaching staff. And that's kind of been the big hot topic right now, right? Because the Bears have that lead late in the game. They're up. Things are going well, and instead of just trying to put their foot on the Lions' throats and end the game and effectively the last nail in the coffin, they get conservative. They settle for field goals. especially on that drive where they milked as much clock as they did. That's the type of drive where if you milk that much clock and you pound it in, it's game over. The other team quits at that point. You go, son of a bitch, we tried. But no, they gave them life. And the Lions are way too good of a team now to give them life, as we clearly saw on Sunday. So, Q, I want to know, even if it's just kind of the high-level big picture here, what the hell is going through your head with this coaching staff right now? And some of these decisions that, again, have cost the Bears a victory on the field.
I just don't understand. I mean, so, right, you're up, what were you up, five? On that last, second to last drive, and you're running the ball on first and second down, just like straight handoffs. And you've been running naked boots all day. You feel pretty good about Justin Fields' ability to get back to the line of scrimmage and stay in bounds on those naked boots if he has to. Or even they don't even have to be naked boots. They can be any type of rollout. And that's the equivalent of running up the middle for a loss, right? So you're saying we're going to have these shots for you to go get a first down, but if they're not there, you can either run or just make sure you get back to the line of scrimmage. Mm-hmm. And you're net even. Like based on like relative to obviously 2020 hindsight, but relative to running up the middle for nothing. Right. And I didn't get to the replay of that point in the game, but I can assume that the Lions were playing pretty heavy in the box at that point. Like, I mean, they had the shot to Tyler Scott. Mm-hmm. I have to imagine that was created by a heavy box. Yeah. And it's just why so conservative, man. I know, like, Eberflus, the juices are probably flowing a little bit at that point. Like, my defense has arrived. We're here. Give us the shot. But you know what? The shot needs to go to Justin Fields. Mm-hmm. He's who we need to see. He's who needs to be evaluated going into next year. He's the guy who we need to know more about in these situations. Not so much the defense. The defense has already given you so much in this game.
Oh, yeah.
Why put it back on their shoulders? Mm-hmm. And that just... Oh, man. So that's not even the part that infuriated me the most. The part that infuriated me the most was use your timeouts.
Yeah.
I don't care that you're on defense. The Lions are in the red zone just taking that clock down to not even give your offense a chance because they feel pretty good about getting a touchdown. They should. The Bears defense has shown you that they should feel pretty good about getting a touchdown here. Use your timeouts to get a real chance and not give Justin Fields 30 seconds to go get a field goal to tie it up at least. Yeah. I mean, that's the part that really killed me. It was like you listening to it, you could feel it's like they're gonna mess this up. They're gonna get the ball back with 20 seconds. I know it. I just know it because they're not using these timeouts. They're just gonna end up in this terrible spot that no one there's no you end up pressing, you end up saying, I need a play now, and then like we've seen with Fields time and time again in that moment, it ends in a really negative play.
Yep. Yeah. And I agree with you. I think again, hindsight's 2020. I think you put that incredibly perfectly, Q. You took the words right out of my mouth. But in that situation, it almost becomes the, well, if you're not conservative and your offense can just go down and kill the clock and maybe you add a field goal and at least they have to get a touchdown just to tie it. Then all of a sudden you're feeling pretty good with your defense out there, right? Like instead of being like, no, we're going to put it on our defense. Cause to your point, Q, the defense gave them everything they possibly could have. Tyreek Stevenson makes a great play to get that interception in this one. Jalen Johnson probably should have had a pick six in this one when the Lions were deep in their own or deep in Bears territory. TJ Edwards gets a big pick. Tremaine Edmonds gets another pick, right? Eberflus was hell-bent on having his linebackers, and they balled out. They've had good seasons. TJ Edwards, low-key, might be in a position for an all-pro nod. I mean, he's been that good. He's setting Bears records for linebackers. Like, that's new-level shit if you're an NFL linebacker. If you're setting Bears linebacking records for tackles in X amount of games, you're clearly doing something right. They gave them everything they possibly could have. I agree with you, Q. Why in the absolute hell do you feel the need to put it back on their shoulders? They are not the Bears of 05 and 06 defenses, right? Where they could take over games. That's not A, that's not football anymore. Let's be completely clear. That those days are dead and done.
If it is, it's one season. Because it's not going to repeat the next season. Like, that's right. Where we're at. Like, the Browns right now, they're that defense. Yes. But next year's Browns will probably not be that defense.
Right. Because somebody's either going to find a way to beat them, or they're just going to naturally lose guys because guys go off and get paid and go elsewhere. Like, that's just the nature of the beast. The Bears got very lucky that they kept those defenses together during the 2000s the way they did. At least the core pieces, right? And then they rotated in the Hunter Hill and Myers and the Nick Roaches of the world, and they did just fine. But I agree with you. Give your potentially franchise quarterback. The reports came out from Ian Rappaport that over the weekend that, in my opinion, flew very under the radar as well. He said the Bears need to be absolutely blown away by a quarterback in the draft process to move on from Fields. The fact that they even feel that way already tells me that they're probably looking at this quarterback class saying, are these guys really better than Justin?
Yeah.
So why not give your quarterback a chance to go prove it? You've told the media that he's got 7 games.
My other thought with that is we're not giving him away for free is the other message they're sending.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. So why not go out there and either A, let him prove that he's the guy to, you know, wear orange and blue for the next however many years, or B, you improve his freaking trade value if you're really that hell-bent on getting rid of him. But you still got to give your quarterback a chance to win the game. Like you said, not with 20 seconds on the clock and 3 timeouts. I don't give a fuck if you have the 3 timeouts at that point. I'd rather have a full clock and let him march down that way than have the timeouts.
With no timeouts is a much better situation.
100%. Because the difference is you can run routes to the sideline that take 6 to 10 seconds to develop. You're not, your back's not against the wall. So I agree with you, Q. I think incredibly well put. Another frustrating. And then to double down on it, Eberflus gets up there and, you know, blames the players and prides himself on calling the defense. And it's just like, the fuck is going on right now?
Yeah, I listened to that. It was a weird, like, if you listen to the full sound clip, it's like,
I don't know that
he was saying what people were saying he was saying, but like, man, you got to have more awareness than to say it that way. You know, like, I mean, that you know how it's going to get twisted. But like, I'm not sure he was exactly putting it on the players who listened to the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But like, if you can take one clip from it and make it sound that bad, you need to rethink how you're saying it.
100%. And I want to give flowers where it's due. He's joined you on this show this year, so anybody that habitually listens to Bears On Tap knows the name. But our friend here at On Tap Sports, at Mr. Nick DeMayo, wrote up an incredible, incredible article. I'm trying to find it here. I'm currently scrolling through. Ah, here it is. Yes, Matt Eberflus continues to answer questions using riddles over reason. Like, that's all it's been this year. Like, what is it about Matt Eberflus that he just can't answer a question straight? Like, is it just that he's not good in front of the media thing? Or is it he's just not fit to answer questions? Like, it really does. Because to your point, Q, right? If any of your sound bites, because your words are all over the place, can be twisted into shit, you're clearly not answering the question properly.
Right.
Like, what do you attribute to the defense falling apart? Hey, our defense was tired at the end of the game. But you know what? They went out there and they gave us a really good opportunity. And I bet you there's probably a lot of things that we're going to watch on film that we could have A, done better on the field, and B, done better from a decision-making process. But at the end of the day, our defense did what we asked them to do, and we can't be upset about the performance that they put out on Sunday. What the fuck's wrong with that answer? I came up with it in 3 seconds on the fly. This guy probably gets 5 minutes, 10 minutes to prepare at least of like, what do I think I want to have my theme be and all this? And it's like every time it comes out as crap. Like Scott from Iowa says here, Eberflus definitely doesn't have a career in stand-up. I agree. Because the guy's not just, he's not able to formulate complete thoughts.
I don't know.
That makes sense.
Quickly. That what's up yours line was pretty funny to me, but.
Yeah, okay. Touche. He's got a couple of one-hitters every once in a while, but I don't know.
Honestly, the funniest part was just how giddy he looked to, like, get it out. He was so ready for it.
That's the dad joke that he's got fired up and ready to go, and he's waiting for somebody to tee him up for it. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Everybody's got that one relative, whether it's, like, a parent or an uncle or something like that, that's, like, they like, they try to set you up for it and they're like giggling before they can deliver it. And then you like, you almost like know it's coming and you give it to them and they're like,
oh man, that entire sequence between him saying at halftime, we got something up our sleeve, and just the look on his face as he said it to the post game, like, what's up yours, was just like, it was some of the best television I've ever seen. It's just, it was hysterical just to watch his face through all of that. But I mean, if I'm being honest here, like, and it's something that no one wants to like think about or talk about during head coach like thought process, because it's not something that actually matters to the game, right? But I think it's something that matters on a personal mental health level for these coaches as they come in, is like Matt Eberflus. You look at where he came from, like Dallas. Sure, it's a big national media landscape, but the local media, I don't think comes close to what how you're going to get hounded in a Chicago and a New York and a Philadelphia.
Those are like the big three right there.
Yeah. And you look at Indianapolis, I don't think they're getting grilled this way. Like having someone who is prepared to handle the gauntlet that is taking on Chicago's local media is, I think, something that actually does matter, because it's going to impact their ability to do their job. Yeah. And I'm just not sure he's a guy who was, again, in hindsight, but I'm not sure he's a guy who was prepared for that and was, had the answers to handle that. I mean, I thought Nagy actually handled that stuff pretty well in his time here, coming from KC, because I think KC's a pretty rabid fan base in a more local area, where like the local coverage, I don't think it's up to the same level, but I think it's prepared you more than a Dallas or Indianapolis did. Because like even when Eberflus was in Dallas, how often was he talking to the media? You know,
never. I mean, he was a linebacker.
Wasn't coach. Really a thing. And yeah. Jerry, I think Jerry Jones does a pretty good job of protecting his coaches from that stuff.
Sure.
So it's, I think there's some preparation and experience there that, I mean, maybe you can look to a Philadelphia coaching staff or something to try to, if when you're interviewing guys for, if the head coaching job comes available, that might be something you're paying a little bit of attention to. Not something that's a deciding factor, I think, but something you want to pay just a little bit of attention to.
And a fascinating thought, truthfully, because actually, if you do look right at some of these markets, look at the Eagles, right? Guys move on, and Doug Peterson leaves, and they have to rechange, and Sirianni comes in, and you know what I mean? They kind of had that flow of just the guys they develop internally, and they become good coaches and things like that. And then even when they go on and move into other places, right? Like, that's why I think we see the Andy Reid and Doug Peterson trees get so much notoriety in the coaching circles, because, well, you know how to handle that market, right? Brian DeBole at times, I think, in New York probably feels a bit overwhelmed. But then you got a guy like Robert Sella, who's, in my opinion, handles the New York media incredibly well.
Yeah.
And but he also came right, Kyle Shanahan, who comes from Mike Shanahan, who knows the landscape, right? Like,
well, he came from Washington, I think. Yeah. I think Sala was involved, or no, was he? I forget Sala was, if he was with Shanahan or a different branch. I think he was a Kubiak guy, so probably not. I'm probably mistaken on that. I think he came from the Texans under Kubiak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's interesting to see. This is an interesting comment here from Scott, though, really quick before we start to move this into our final segment here of the show, Q, and that is. Scott says David Kaplan brought up a great point this morning. He says this is the same Chicago media that ran Lovey out of town with a record of 10-6. He says, in his opinion, give them nothing. Treat them like Belichick. It's interesting. It is a rabid media market. And I have a good buddy of mine, a guy I went to school with, who actually works in NFL media. He works in NFL PR. And he said, he's like, you get to learn, even if you're in one specific market, like you learn about all the other markets. Like that's just natural because you're communicating with them on a weekly basis, trading notes and things like that. There's a lot of prep that goes into the PR side of the house. And he said, he goes, Chicago is probably one of the craziest markets from a media standpoint. He goes, it's New York, it's Chicago. He goes, LA doesn't even sniff those two when it comes to football. He goes, the Rams have it cushy out in LA. In comparison, he goes, I think the, like you said, Philadelphia is a bigger media market like that than, you know, any others. That's really the big three. People in Chicago are crazy when it comes to media.
Thinking about Chicago, when the Cubs are bad, if the White Sox are good, does it help the Cubs from a media aspect? I'd say they cover up some of the shit.
Yeah, maybe.
And vice versa, when the Sox are bad, the Cubs being good covers it up a little bit, because it's like, who wants to talk about the losing team when there's a winning team in town?
Right. Unless you're the beat guy that has to, right? But like from a large standpoint, agreed. Yes.
Right. Like New York, they got the two teams. Mm-hmm. I think Chicago and Philly are standalone in the NFL of like, those are the two toughest, because those two, they're alone.
Yeah.
They're like, you go into Chicago in October, if baseball is not in the playoffs, or if baseball's not in the playoffs, basketball hasn't started yet, hockey hasn't started yet, you turn on sports radio, it's the Bears, it's the Eagles. It is 24 hours of Bears and Eagles all the time. In New York, it might be Giants, it might be Jets. Whichever one is better or worse. Who's
capturing the headlines?
Whichever one's worse is going to take the more heat. Like right now, I'm sure the New York radio waves are a lot more about Brian Daboll than they are the Jets and Aaron Rodgers' injury, because 100%. they're going to pile on the worst side or pile on the better side. It's not going to be central to one team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. Incredibly well put, Q. And I think that's something that needs to be considered. It's just it's a rabid media market, and that's really what it is. And it's tough. It's a tough gig to come in and take, and especially the Bears, right? I think the Blackhawks to an extent, right? The Bulls, I think the Bulls really get it just because of Jordan and everything like that. But when it comes to media, man, it's football. It's the NFL. Yeah. And in Chicago's case, it's the Bears. And like you said, they stand alone on that front. Q, let's have some fun with this episode, because I think we've talked a lot about these serious topics, and Thanksgiving is around the corner. First off, happy Thanksgiving to all those that celebrate, that listen to our show. We hope you are safe. We hope you have a great time with your family and friends. Hopefully you get to eat a lot of good food and just enjoy and be thankful for the things that you do of your life. So we're going to play a little bit of things you are thankful for from the Chicago Bears. And I know this, you know, probably for a lot of people, you probably just rolled your eyes. I can already hear them in the future, Q. As we're live recording this, when they're listening to this in podcast form, the heavy, oh, you got to be fucking kidding me. What is there to be thankful for with these Bears right now? I can already feel it. I can already just, the energy shift is already happening in the world. But Q, I want to start it off. We're each going to have two things we are thankful for here. So I want to let you lead things off. What is one thing you are thankful for right now with the Chicago Bears?
First thing, I'm going present, which is, there's not a lot, but like, I'm a trench guy. I love trench play. O-line. I'm thankful for Ryan Poles' commitment to building the O-line the right way. I really think the Bears have a future on this O-line with Braxton Jones, Tevin Jenkins, and Darnell Wright. Nate Davis fits in there somewhere. I'm not sure how long-term he will be here, but I feel like the first three guys I mentioned, that's 5 years starting O-line. Like that, that is your base, and you have those guys cheap for the next few years still. I think there's a lot to be thankful for with the base of this O-line and how that's going to help them build the team into the future.
100%. Scott says minus the center as his response to you.
Well, the center is still to be determined. But
Yep. They're still building that spot. Agreed. I like that. Q, I'm going to stay on that path here with you. I had one in the back of my head, but I wasn't sure about the second one yet. And I'm going to flip it to the other side of the ball. And I'm thankful that despite all the harsh feedback and despite all this, you know, oh, it's going to be a top, you know, the 35 to 40 pick that they gave away for, you know, at the trade deadline, I am thankful for Montez Sweat's addition to this defensive line, because they look like a different unit. And he got his first sack on Sunday as a Bear, but even without the sack numbers, you've seen his tangible impact on this defensive unit the last couple of weeks that he's been here. I think it's been some of the best Bears defensive football we've seen in probably the last three, maybe 4 years. It's been that good. So I am thankful for number 98. I know he took your boy Jervon Dexter's number, and now it's weird seeing him number 99. I almost have to correct myself mentally. I'm like, who the hell's 99? I'm like, oh, that's right. They switched numbers. But I am thankful for Montez Sweat's addition to the
Bears. Actually, I think what happened there, I think Dexter was, or wait, what's Dexter's number now? You're saying
99.
Yeah, I think he was 99. I think 98 was a training camp number. And then when they cut Travis Gibson, he switched to 99. I could be off on that, but that's what I thought happened. Because I went down a rabbit hole on this, I think week five. I was like, why is this picture 98, but he wears 99?
Oh, maybe you're right, dude. Because 99 is the only number listed as his pro football. See, that's trippy because you know what it is for me? Like defensive linemen, I don't pay attention to numbers. I don't. Yeah. I just don't. And like I remember seeing 98 on Sweat Night. I was like, wait, wasn't that Jervon Dexter's number? But now that you bring that up, that's wild. Maybe that was what created it. He waited till Gibson got cut and switched it, and then it just flew under the radar. I feel like a total doofus now, but touche.
Oh, man. I'm
you,
sorry.
You got me there. No, hey, I'm glad. I don't feel so ridiculous now that, like, I thought he was number 98 all year. But, Q, do you have another item that you were thankful for with the Chicago Bears?
Yeah, and this one's a little different spin on it. I am thankful for how wrong we all were in 2019 about the Bears offense and Mitch Trubisky and everything around it. Because if that had never happened, like when that happened, I became so like obsessed about how did I miss this badly? How did everyone miss this badly? Mm-hmm. And that's what drove, like, I didn't watch tape like that before. I didn't go dive into numbers the same way before. It was like that drove me into becoming the level of like fan of content creator of whatever you want to call it that I am now and that I'm still striving to be. So I'm thankful for how poorly that was all read and understood, because it made me question everything I know about football and made me care that much more about everything I'm looking at.
That's a hell of an answer. I love that. That's awesome. No, that's fantastic. I think that's incredible, man. And you know, I'll double down on something I'm thankful for here. And like you said, definitely the how you think about football. I feel like as I've gotten older, the thought process changes, right? Especially after playing, because you know, growing up, you watch and you know it's the pro offense and it's the pro offense, and then like Oregon did something weird and crazy, and what are they doing? And then it changed football. Football's always changing, right? So I think on that structure, I'm thankful that there's one thing the Bears, I think, have understood is changing in football, and that is you need a true elite number one wide receiver, and I think the Bears have that. I'm thankful for DJ Moore, because if nothing else, he is worth me tuning in every single week, because I loved him as a Panther. I thought the Bears should have went and got him at the deadline instead of Chase Claypool, even if it meant, you know, giving up more. But ultimately it worked out. He still ended up in Chicago. And you know what? For his sake, I hope it's not the Moose and Muhammad proverb of this is where Bears receiver, you know, this is where receivers' careers go to die. I hope that trend ends. I want that narrative to die. Not just players' careers.
Just because of that narrative, I hope the Bears draft his son.
That would be really funny. It would be really funny. It is also
Moose Jr.'s down there at Texas A&M.
I was gonna say it's also trippy that Moose Jr. is like almost draft eligible now. That makes me feel really old. It's crazy, man. But I am thankful for that. And Q, before we wrap up, we got to make it fun, right? Two things we're not thankful for in Chicago Bears football. What are you can list them both off if you want, or we can go back and forth. Up to you. But what are you not thankful for, Q, in Bears football?
Eddie Jackson's age. He's just not, he doesn't seem like the same player anymore. And the Bears wasted his best years and it sucks, but they did. Here we are. I'm not sure he has another year with the Bears. I'd honestly be here for giving him another shot, but I mean, I don't know if it's a smart thing to do anymore. So that's the first thing I am not thankful for, is that Eddie Jackson's best years were wasted.
Yeah, that's incredibly well put, man. And I agree. I think, right, he came onto the scene so quickly in 2017, and everybody was excited for it. like you said, you know, he's only got one real true year of contract left, 2024. He's due to make $18.1 million. When guys get into that last year of these contracts, they kind of almost become de facto cap cut casualties, right? Especially if they're not performing up to standard. I agree with you. That's a very good one. Something I am not thankful for, Q, with the Chicago Bears is I'm really not thankful for how they designed Soldier Field. I am not thankful for that because I understand why they kept it. It's a national landmark. What it stands for at its core, I think, is a beautiful thing, right? It's to honor the soldier. It's to honor those that were lost that maybe were never named. And I think everything that the history surrounding the field is fantastic. But dropping that disorganized fucking spaceship into the middle of it was not the right answer. And president and our fearless leader here at OnTap Sportsnet, Tony Marchese, got to join me the other night on that Thursday night game. And as we ventured around and having to deal with all the stupid ramps and staircases and all that garbage, it's just not a well-organized stadium. And I get why they are pressing so hard for Arlington Heights. I think what Soldier Field is at its core, and I think the incredible history that's a part of it, not only just for what it stands for, but what the Bears had there, I think is great. I am not thankful for its design, though, because it is just poor, and it's just not good. Not good.
I've only actually been there once, and I was 15 years old, so I can't speak too much on it. But, I mean, it's tiny.
It is tiny.
All I can tell you. I think it looks beautiful, but it's not about the looks anymore, you know?
A lot of it's functionality and people being able to what can you do with the stadiums? And plus, I mean, Jerry started it all. Bigger is better. And you know, everything's bigger in Texas, and that certainly seems to be the way. Q, do you have another thing you are not thankful for with the Chicago Bears?
I'm not thankful for quote the Bears ownership. Lack of futurism, end quote. Martellus Bennett. If you didn't check out Martellus Bennett's rant on the Bears ownership,
definitely
check it out. It's on Twitter. And
shameless plug, it's over at ontapsportsnet.com too.
And over at ontapsportsnet. basically, he rants about the Bears' entire business model being selling the past and reaching back to 1985 to continue to rile up people's hearts and dreams and what they love, and that it's, you know, you can't just keep going back to Bill Polian to fix stuff for you because it keeps being broken. So there's that the antiquated mindset that the Bears continue to operate with. Hopefully Kevin Warren's changing that, but until we're proven that, it's something I'm very not thankful for.
Yeah. Incredibly well put. Agree with that. I think reading that just it further infuriates, I think, the normal Bears fan, because I think especially right like our generation Q of Bears fans, we weren't alive when they won the Super Bowl back in 1985. We weren't, even for those 80s teams that were really good. Very few of us in our age demographic right now were alive for those games. A lot of us remember the shit Bears of the 90s. The shit Bears of the early 2000s, the golden lovey years, and then all the garbage that's come since. That's all we know. So, yeah, it's cool that a lot of these 85 Bears like to stay around the city and are still a part of the Chicago community. And I think that's great. I've been very lucky to meet a handful of those guys myself. But no offense to them, I didn't fucking watch you play. And I'm not going to get as excited as, you know, my parents or, you know, even like my older siblings that might have been alive for that, because I didn't see it. I have no personal connection to it. Give me a new winner and then you can sell the past to me all you fucking want. The Cubs keep me invested from that standpoint as it is. Like, keep it coming, baby. We like that shit here in Chicago. But like, now your demographic is starting to age out that actually remember those 85 teams. And now they are just falling behind. And it is eventually going to start to hit where our generation just says, we barely know what good Bears football looks like. So why the fuck do we care? Because we don't have any connection to that team.
The best player of my post-college years is playing for the Chargers. I mean.
Yeah. Agreed. Agreed. And the probably the best player that we've probably watched in our lifetime is is one of the greatest middle linebackers ever that was a safety, and the other guy needs to be in the Hall of Fame, but they don't want to put him in there because he's a special teamer.
Yeah.
That's what we know. We never got the honor to watch Walter Payton. Trust me, I wish I could have. I would have loved to be unable to watch Walter live. I think that would have been incredible. I would have loved to watch that 85 team. I would have loved to have celebrated the Super Bowl with the rest of Chicago. But guess what? I wasn't even a twinkle in my parents' eye yet. So there's no connection there. I love that, Q. Well put. And I think that's a good PSA for the Bears in general. Is you're starting to – our generation doesn't give a rat's ass about 85 because we weren't alive. Give us something to actually be invested in and be excited about. Otherwise, you're going to start losing people. Q, I had this in my head, and I was like thinking about this as something I was thankful for. Maybe it's something that I will be not thankful for. And it's – I'm not thankful for the fact that, like, people forget about Matt Forte. Matt Forte was like one of my favorite Chicago Bears. And I like borderline didn't know it as a kid growing up. And then now that he's gone, I'm like, fuck, I missed that guy.
Yeah.
Like he was ahead of his time for the running back position. He would have he caught 100 passes in a season. One of only a handful of running backs to ever do that. Could you imagine Matt Forte today in today's NFL?
I mean, extremely valuable.
Oh my God. He's up there with Christian McCaffrey in fantasy football every year.
He'd be Austin Eckler, but better at running the ball. Like,
yeah, and bigger.
Yeah.
Because, like, Forte was freakishly large for a running back. He was, like, 6 feet, 6'1". I mean, he was huge for a running back. And he held up incredibly well over a very long time. That I am not thankful for the fact that people just forget how great Matt Forte was. And just sit back and you need to just – people need to sit back in and think, like, what he could be in today's game. Go make him in your Madden game and chuck him on the Bears and see what happens. It's going to be nuts. He would be a monster. And I miss that guy. 22 was a stud. So that is something I am not thankful for. Q, this was a fun episode. Happy Thanksgiving to you, my friend, and all of yours. Always a pleasure. We'll be back. And next time you hear from us, it's because the Bears play the day before we go live. They play Monday Night Football this coming week against the Vikings. Q, I got to hear it from you. Thoughts going into that game on Monday Night Football against the Vikings up in Minneapolis.
Brian Flores had Justin Fields in knots the last time they played. This is an important game. This might be the most important game for Justin Fields the rest of the way, outside of maybe the Cleveland game, to show that he is growing. Because he couldn't do a thing against Brian Flores last time they played. It was ugly. And he needs to show that that is changing. So big, big game for him.
I couldn't agree more. I actually have nothing else to add besides to the Bears need to avenge the Amir Smith-Marset game from yesteryear. Because that game was bullshit. Darnell Mooney perhaps made one of the catches of the year in that game. For those that forget that sweet one-handed over the back catch, they probably should have won that game and they didn't because, you know, he fumbled and then he spat in the Bears' faces on Thursday Night Football as a Panthers kick returner and took one back to the house. But that's neither here nor there. Avenge the Amir Smith-Marset game. That's my addition to your thoughts there, Q, for this one coming up on Monday Night Football. Also, I'm sick and tired of the Bears being on prime time. Just stop. But we get a red zone Sunday as a result of it. So it's
always a beautiful thing.
It's two red zone Sundays in a row because then they go on the bye week the following week. So it's hard to be upset about that, truthfully. I think as a Bears fan, just given the way this season's gone. Q, a score prediction for Monday Night Football.
Life's too short to pick the Bears to lose. give me Bears 19, Vikings 17.
I like it. I need at the end of the season, Q, I'm going to need a compilation of just that repeated every single time.
Yeah.
Of just you going, life's too short to pick the Bears to lose. And I'm like, yeah, I love it every single time. You know what, Q? I liked a lot of what we saw in this game against the Lions. I know it wasn't perfect and they obviously ended up losing, but the defense stepped up against a very good offensive team in the Detroit Lions. The offense got the job done. 26 points is still fantastic at the end of the day, especially at, you know, what we've seen in that Carolina game and some of these other games this season, I too believe that life is too short, at least this week, to pick the Bears to lose. I think it's going to be a close one, just like you do. And I think the Vikings are due for a loss. They've been really hot lately. They're due. They're due. I'm going to take the Bears 23, Vikings 21 in this one. I think it's going to be close, but I think the Bears could find a way to pull it out. And to your point, if Justin Fields balls out, that's a big feather in his cap for, you know, his future now in the NFL.
Hey, and it's an undisputed fact that Josh Dobbs has never beat the Bears.
It's true. It's true.
Let's not start now because I think he's going to be in Minnesota for a while.
He might be. He might be, especially if they say sayonara to Kirk Cousins and maybe need to draft the quarterback and develop him for a year. I think we could see Josh Dobbs in purple and white for at least another season or two.
I'll go a step further, man. I think Josh Dobbs has shown a lot this year. And I don't know that he's a franchise quarterback, but I think he's enough for a team to say, we could make this work and give a few years for him. So, I mean, I really do think the Vikings might stick with Josh Dobbs for a few years.
Q, I have to ask you an honest question. Who would you have given 3 years and, oh, what was it, $48 million or whatever it was to? Joshua Dobbs or Mike Lennon?
Josh Dobbs.
Okay. Yeah, me too. I just,
in hindsight, in the preseason I was talking about, I was like, who's Josh? Like,
you know, oh, yeah.
I was expecting nothing from him. I knew him from his Tennessee days, but I also knew he'd been in the NFL for like 5 years and done absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
But dude's balling out. Dude has a photographic memory. He's a rocket scientist. Like,
literally,
there's a lot of reasons to think he's going to keep doing what he's doing.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it for Dobbs, just really quick, I'm not going to stay on this topic for long, but I think a lot of it for Dobbs was just opportunity. He sat behind Big Ben in Pittsburgh for a long time. Then he kind of bounced around a lot. Just people weren't sure what they were going to have from him. And then he took advantage of the opportunity this year with Arizona with Kyler being hurt. He won that job over Clayton Tune coming out of training camp. And ultimately, at the end of the day, like you said, man, he's balled out and he's at least earned himself another contract in this league. And we all know quarterbacks get paid. So he's going to make a nice chunk of change in the offseason, which, hey, good for him. I'm always supportive of players going out and getting their money. Q, it's always a pleasure, my friend. Before we get out here, I want to remind everybody, Bears on Top is one of two official Bears podcasts here covering the Chicago Bears at the On Tap Sports Network. Check out our friends over at Bears Nation Pod. They do a great job there at Bears Nation Pod on the socials. Be sure to check them out. Be sure to check us out as well at Bears on Tap. You know the drill. We have everything for you here covered. He's at Butkus Stats. I am at Loose on Tap. Don't forget about our boy at Juice on Tap as well. And all our friends of the program that help contribute here to the Bears side of the house. Folks, we got it all. Both sides of baseball. It's baseball free agency. Ron Luce is poking the Cubs with a fucking stick, telling them to do something. At least the White Sox are doing stuff, even if they're bringing in Paul DeJong and making weird trades, and they're at least doing things. But you can check out all of that at the respective sides of town, Bulls, Blackhawks as well. And we've got all of it for you here at the On Tap Sports Network. Also, be sure to check out the YouTube. You know the drill. Like, subscribe, hit the bell button, and you always know when all of our great shows go live, just like we did here tonight with Bears on Tap. OnTapSportsNet.com, at OnTapSportsNet on the socials, the OnTap Sports Network. Go and check out what's on tap in Chicago sports. Q, once again, happy Thanksgiving to you, my friend. Happy Thanksgiving to all of our listeners. And we'll be back after Monday Night Football between the Bears and Vikings. Until then, Q, bear down.
Bear down.